disinterested altruism, or whether there's something Chicken Little wanted. And once Chicken Little had all the other chickens convinced that the sky was falling, was there, all of a sudden, a federal department of falling sky? And did Chicken Little get appointed secretary of things that hit you on the head? A cabinet post is an excellent springboard to higher office. You can almost hear Chicken Little's New Hampshire primary speech. My feathered friends, our coops are guarded by foxes. All our eggs are in one basket. We're living on chicken feed. Massive layoffs are threatened at KFC, plus the sky is falling. In these troubled times, who better to lead us in squawking and fluttering and running around after our heads have been cut off than the Honorable C. Little, a real chicken? You must know that the politicians loathe you. They think you're a moron. They have to make rules and regulations, or you'd screw up everything. You'd fall right out of the car if it weren't for seatbelt laws. And you can't be trusted with money. You'd spend it on fatty foods and cigarettes, or a powerboat that would harm the environment. The politicians need to get that money away from you. They have to raise taxes quick. Better let the government look after your cash. Government will do worthwhile things with your paycheck, such as lend it to Mexico, and fund educational TV, because you'd watch nothing but football in Melrose Place if it weren't for serious and informative nature programs about how Democrats are facing extinction. And you're as mean as you are stupid. You're too selfish to help the poor, so politicians have to take even more of what you earn and give it to the poor people. Well, of course, politicians can't actually give that money to poor people. Then the poor people wouldn't be poor and would turn into Republicans or something. Poor people don't really need money anyway. They need government programs and housing projects and a large welfare bureaucracy to make sure they stay in the housing projects and don't get out and start wandering around the parts of town where politicians live. Damn them all, these ballot lice with their jiggery pokery of compassion and their pimping for virtue on the stump. The greater common good should get a good one right where it will do some good. And here's another for those who say they care, something for them to care about that's big, shoe-shaped, and black and blue. To hell and a job in the private sector with the lot of them. Politics is the work of parasites, condescending parasites at that. We are being patronized by our own ear mites and liver flukes. Politics is, wait, there's a rumbling from the National Affairs Desk. Better than sex? Hunter, Hunter, you're supposed to be alone in the voting booth. What kind of sex are we talking about here? And politics doesn't work. Look at the parts of America where government has had the most power, where government has spent the most money. Look at those housing projects we've got the poor people in. Then say to yourself, what the government has done for folks in the inner cities, it can do that for spotted owls. But all my Republican buddies cavorting on Capitol Hill, aren't they politicians too? Alas, you betcha. It would be nice if they stuck to the lovely task of destroying government, but there's no such thing as politicians who can mind their own business. Republican congressmen are going to want to make some positive contributions to our political system, and you may not feel too positive about that. For one thing, some of us Republicans are anti-abortion on the theory that every fetus is a Republican or, if adopted by a nice rich family, will be when it turns 30. And some Republicans want children to read a prayer before school. Although, whether it is the Republican insistence on children learning to pray, or the Republican insistence on children learning to read, which has the National Education Association so upset, I'm not sure. There are certain Republicans who would like to get rid of immigrants, these Republicans being under the impression that Pat Buchanan is a Cherokee name. If Republicans have their way, poor people in crime-ridden neighborhoods will no longer be given squalid housing. They'll have to buy it. And, under the Republicans, certain large corporations and business interests no doubt will be allowed to run wild, as opposed to the way the Clinton administration cracked down on Tyson chicken and cattle futures trading. But that's about it in the way of Republican innovations. We don't have that many ideas. Democrats have lots of them. Every time a politician gets an idea, it costs you money, and sometimes, in the case of wars, it costs you your skin. Republicans are cheaper. We leave you alone. And when Republicans pull some sleazy thing like Whitewater, at least it works. You didn't see Michael Milken going to jail for not selling junk bonds. Plus, you know where you stand with Republicans. Everybody realizes we're SOBs. Not like the Democrats, always claiming to be the spiritual scions of Mahatma Gandhi. You don't want a politician trying to drown you while the whole world thinks he's giving you a bath. And one more extremely important thing about Republicans. We're against gun control. You can shoot us. Bad sports. As was mentioned before, ignorance is valuable to a humorist, but clumsy, incompetent, useless idiocy is a treasure beyond price. A joke needs a butt. Folly needs a fool. And each item of comical writing needs someone in it of whom merciless fun can be made. The problem is finding a person like that who won't sue. The author has been enormously lucky in this regard. Whenever he sat down at the typewriter, he found himself close at hand. Fly Fishing, Rod and Reel, 1987. I'd never fly fished. I'd done other kinds of fishing. I'd fished for bass. That's where I'd get far enough away from the dock so that people couldn't see there was no line on the pole, then drink myself blind in the rowboat. And I deep-sea fished. That's where the captain would get me blind before we'd even left the dock, and I'd be the one who couldn't see the line. But I'd never fly fished. I'd always been of two minds about the sport. On the one hand, here's a guy standing in cold water up to his liver, throwing the world's most expensive clothesline at trees. A full two-thirds of his time is spent untangling stuff, which he could be doing in the comfort of his own home with old shoelaces if he wanted. The whole business costs like sin and requires heavier clothing. Furthermore, it's conducted in the middle of black fly season. Cast and swat, cast and swat. Fly fishing may be a sport invented by insects with fly fishermen as their bait. And what does the truly sophisticated dry fly artist do when he finally bags a fish? He lets the full thing go and eats bologna sandwiches instead. On the other hand, fly fishing did have its attractions. I love to waste time and money. I had ways to do this most of the year. Hunting, skiing, renting summer houses in Tuhelangon Harbor for a Lebanon hostage's ransom. But come spring, I was limited to cleaning up the yard. Even with a new Toro every 2 years and a lot of naps by the compost heap, it's hard to waste much time and money doing this. And then there's the gear needed for fly fishing. I am a sucker for anything that requires more equipment than I have sense. My workshop is furnished with a full panoply of Black & Decker power tools, all from one closet shelf I installed in 1979. When I began to think about fly fishing, I realized I'd never be content again until my den was cluttered with computerized robot fly-tying vices, space-age Teflon and ceramic knotless tapered leaders, sterling silver English fish scissors, and 35 volumes on the home life of the midge. And there was one other thing. I'm a normal male who takes an occasional nip. Therefore, I love to put funny things on my head. Sometimes it's the nut dish, sometimes the spaghetti colander, but the hats I've seen fly fishermen wear were funnier than either, and I had to have one. I went to Hackles and Tackles, an upscale dry fly specialty shop that also sells fish print wallpaper and cashmere V-neck sweaters with little trout on them. I got a graphite rod for about the price of a used car, and a reel made out of the kind of exotic alloys that you can go to jail for selling to the Soviet Union. I also got one of those fishing vests that only comes down to the top of your beer gut and looks like you dressed in the dark and tried to put on your 10-year-old son's three-piece suit. And I purchased lots of monofilament and teensy hooks covered in auk down and moose lint, and an entire L.L. Bean boat bag full of fly fishing do-whats, hinky-doovers, and whatchamajigs. I also brought home a set of fly fishing how-to videotapes. This is the 80s, I reasoned, the age of video. What better way to take up a sport than from a comfortable armchair? That's where I'm at my best with most sports anyway. There were three tapes. The first one claimed it would teach me to cast. The second would teach me to advanced cast. And the third would tell me where trout live, how they spend their weekends, and what they'd order for lunch if there were underwater delicatessens for fish. I started the VCR, and a squeaky little guy with an earnest manner and a double funny hat came on, began heaving fly line around, telling me the secret to making beautiful casting loops is... Whoever made these tapes apparently assumed I knew how to tie backing to reel, and line to backing and leader to line, and so on, all the way out to the little feather and fuzz fish snack at the end. I didn't know how to put my rod together. I had to go to the children's section at the public library and check out My Big Book of Fishing, and begin with how to open the package it all came in. A triple granny got things started on the spool. After 12 hours and help from pop rivets and a tube of crazy glue, I managed an Albright knot between backing and line. But my version of nail knot in the leader put Mr. Gordian of ancient Greek knot legend fame strictly on the shelf. It was the size of a hamster and resembled one of the woolly burger flies I'd bought, except in the size you use for killer whales. I don't want to talk about blood knots and tippets. There I was with two pieces of invisible plastic, trying to use fingers the size of a man's thumb while holding a magnifying glass and a tensor lamp between my teeth and gripping nasty tangles of monofilament with each big toe. My girlfriend had to come over and cut me out of this with pinking shears. Personally, I'm going to get one of those 9-year-old Persian kids that they use to make incredibly tiny knots and fine Bukhara rugs and just take him with me on all my fishing trips. What I really needed was a fly fishing how-to video narrated by Mr. Rogers. This would give me advice about which direction to wind the reel, and why I should never try to drive a small imported car while wearing boot foot waders. Because when I stepped on the accelerator, I also stepped on the brake and the clutch. I rewound Mr. Squeaky and started over. I was supposed to keep my rod tip level and keep my rod swinging in a 90-degree arc. When I snapped my wrist forward, I was giving one quick flick of a blackjack to the skull of a mugging victim. When I snapped my wrist back, I was sticking my thumb over my shoulder and telling my brother-in-law to get the hell out of here, and I mean right now, Buster. Though it wasn't explained with quite so much poetry. Then I was told to try these things with a yarn rod. This was something else I'd bought at the tackle shop. It looked like a regular rod tip from a two-piece rod, but with a cork handle. You run a bunch of bright orange yarn through the guides and flip it around. It's supposed to imitate the action of a fly rod in slow motion. I don't know about that, but I do know you can catch and play a 9-pound house cat on a yarn rod, and it's great sport. They're hard to land, however, and I understand catfishing is strictly catch and release if they're under 20 inches. Then I went back to the television and heard about stance, loop control, straight line casts, slack line casts, stripping, mending, and giving myself enough room when practicing in the yard so I wouldn't get tangled in my neighbor's bird feeder. After 60 minutes of videotape, 7 minutes of yarn rod practice, 25 minutes of catfishing, and several beers, I felt I was ready. I picked up the fin tickler and laid out a couple of loops that weren't half bad, if I do say so myself. I'll bet I cast almost 3 times before making macrame out of my weight forward Cortland 444. This wasn't so hard. I also watched the advanced tape, but Squeaky had gone grad school on me. He's throwing reach casts, curve casts, roll casts, steeple casts, and casts he calls squiggles and stutters. He's writing his name with the line in the air. He's making his dry fly look like the Blue Angels. He's pitching things forehand, backhand, and between his wader legs. And, through the magic of video editing, every time his hook-tipped dust kitty hits the water, he lands a trout the size of a canoe. The videotape about trout themselves wasn't much use either. It's hard to get excited about where trout feed when you know that the only way you're going to be able to get a fly to that place is by throwing your fly box at it. I must say, however, all the tapes were informative. Nymphs and streamers are not, as it turns out, naked mythological girls decorating the high school gym with crepe paper. And I learned that the part of fly fishing I'm going to be best at is naming the flies. Woolly hat catcher, blue wing ears nag, overhanging brush muddler, royal Toyota hatchback, O'Rourke's ouchtail, PJ's live worm and bobber. By now I'd reached what I think they call a learning plateau. That is, if I was going to catch a fish with a fly rod, I either had to go get in the water or open the fridge and toss hooks at Mrs. Paul's frozen haddock fillets. I made reservations at a famous fishing lodge on the Old Sable River in Michigan. When I got there and found a place to park among the Saabs and Volvos, the proprietor said I was just a few days early for the Hendrickson hatch. There is, I see, one constant in all types of fishing, which is when the fish are biting, which is almost, but not quite, now. I looked pretty good making false casts in the lodge parking lot. I mean, no one laughed out loud. But most of the other 2,000 young professionals fishing this no-kill stretch of the Old Sable were pretty busy checking to make sure that their trout shirts were color-coordinated with their Reebok wading sneakers. When I stepped in the river, however, my act came to pieces. My line hit the water like an Olympic belly flop medalist. I hooked 4 tree trout in 3 minutes. My back cast had people ducking for cover in Traverse City and Grosse Pointe Farms. Somebody ought to tie a dry fly that looks like a Big Mac. Then there'd be an excuse for the hook winding up in my mouth instead of the fish's. The only thing I could manage to get a drag-free float on was me after I stepped in a hole. And the trout laughed. The next day was worse. I could throw tight loops. I could sort of aim. I could even make a gentle presentation and get the line to lay right every so often. But when I tried to do all of these things at once, I went mental. I looked like Leonard Bernstein conducting Flight of the Bumblebee in Fast Forward. I was driving tent pegs with my rod tip, my slack cast wrapped around my thighs. My straight line cast went straight into the back of my neck. My improved surgeon's loops looked like full Windsors. I had wind knots and everything, including my red ball suspenders. And $200 worth of fly floatant, split shot, Royal Coachman, and polarized sunglasses fell off my body and were swept downstream. Then, Mirabile Dictu, I hooked a fish. I was casting some, I forget the name, nymph, and clumsily yanking it when my rod tip bent and my pulse shot into trade deficit numbers. I lifted the rod, the first thing I'd done right in 2 days, and the trout actually leaped out of the water as if it were trying for a Field and Stream playmate centerfold. I heard my voice go up 3 octaves until I sounded like my little sister in the middle of a puppy litter. "Ooh, that's a boy, that's a baby, yes, come to daddy, woogie woogie woo." It was a rainbow, and I'll bet it was 7 inches long. All right, 5. Anyway, when I grabbed the thing, some of it stuck out both ends of my hand. I haven't been so happy since I passed my driver's license exam. So I'm a fly fisherman now. Of course, I'm not an expert yet, but I'm working on the most important part of fly fishing technique, boring the hell out of anybody who listens. Bird Hunting, Men's Journal, 1994. Some of the best bird covers in New Brunswick are old garbage dumps. The word cover, used in the sense of hunting ground, is a variant of covert, although there is nothing MI6-ish or Mossad-like about game birds, as far as I can tell. Birds do not go to the dump because they're thinking that's the last place I'd look for creatures of natural beauty and untamed grace. Nor do they need to. Given my faculties as a sportsman and the skills of the dogs with which I hunt, birds could hide in the foyers of New Brunswick bedded breakfasts in bowls of wax fruit. Birds go to the dump because, I hate to break this to the friends of the earth, animals have no aesthetics. Eels congregate in the sludge on the bottom of New York Harbor. Trout bite on feather, fur, and tinsel-dry flies as ugly as Barbie clothes. To a raccoon, a trash can is Paris in May. Rabbits desert the most elaborate nature refuges to visit your ill-planned and unweeded vegetable garden. Wild geese adore golf courses, even the unfashionable public kind. And there is nothing, it seems, more gorgeous and fascinating to a deer than the headlights of an oncoming car. Considering animal taste, I'm not sure I want to know why birds are attracted to dumps. And considering my own taste, gin slings, Madras pants, Ed McBain novels, Petula Clark LPs, I'm not sure I want to know why I'm attracted to bird hunting, but I will try to make sense of the matter. I've been shooting in New Brunswick for a decade. Usually 8 or 10 of us make an outing in the fall. We are an ordinary lot, halfway through life's actuarial leech field and pretty well fixed. We are not likely to be tapped for a Benetton ad. Some of us are avid hunters and deadly shots, and some of us had a gun last year that didn't fit and needed a different choke, and the safety kept sticking. I was using the wrong size shot and too light a load. I'm beginning to get arthritis in my shoulder. I had a new bifocal prescription. My boots hurt. The sun got in my eyes. This is not one of those men go off in the woods hunting trips full of drink, flatulence, and lewd Hillary Clinton jokes. For one thing, some of us aren't men. A couple of us aren't even Republicans. We pack neckties, sports coats, skirts, and makeup, although I don't think anyone wears all 4. There is little of the Cro-Magnon in this crowd, though there is something about 3 bottles of wine apiece with dinner and 6 egg breakfasts. Did somebody step on a carp? And you've heard about Hillary whispering to Bill, "Give me 10 inches and hurt me." So he made love to her twice and appointed David Gergen White House Communications Director. Our New Brunswick sojourn is not a wilderness adventure either. We're no Patagonia-clad apostles of the Rio Summit out getting our faces rubbed in Mother Nature's leg hairs, and we're too old to need a 30-mile hike, a wet bedroll, and a dinner of trail mix and puddle water to make us think life is authentic. If we'd wanted to push human endurance to its limits and face the awesome challenges of the natural elements in their uncivilized state, we could have stayed home with the kids. No. We spend the first half of the shoot in the deep woods, but at a good lodge with an excellent chef. The chef not only cooks six-egg breakfasts and Bordeaux absorbent dinners, but packs delightful lunches for us. For example, moose sandwiches, which are much better, also smaller, than they sound. For the second half of the shoot, we drive to the Bay of Fundy and stay at a handsome inn where the sensible innkeepers bring out the old bedspreads and second-string towels, so there'll be no need to apologize for the mess left by gun-cleaning, dog-brushing, and male-pattern baldness. The innkeepers also let us into their kitchen to cook what we've killed. Some of us may not be brilliant shotgunners, but we are all serious game cooks, even though I'm not really used to cooking on a commercial gas range. And those copper-bottom pans the inn has heat up, I think, too fast. And shouldn't there be some kind of government standards or warning labels or something concerning brandy flammability? What we are hunting in New Brunswick is mainly woodcock, Scolopax minor, a chunky, necklace, blunt-winged, mulch-colored bird with a very long beak in the body the size, shape, and heft of a prize beefsteak tomato. Rereading that sentence, I see I have failed to capture in prose the full measure of the woodcock's physical attractiveness. Probably because it looks like a knee-walking shorebird in urgent need of Jenny Craig. It does have lovely eyes, and a wonderful personality, too, for all I know. Anyway, the woodcock is, in fact, a cousin of the sandpiper and the snipe, but makes its home on less expensive real estate. Woodcock live in the alder patches, which occupy, in horizon-knocking profusion, the numberless stream beds and vast marsh bottoms of New Brunswick's flat, damp topography. Alders are a pulpwood shrub whose branches grow in muddled sprays like bad flower arrangements. Hunting in young alder thickets is like walking through something with a consistency between jello and high hurdles. Old alder thickets, which grow as high as 12 feet, present grim, decaying vaults of face-grabbing, hat-snatching limb tangles. But the alder thickets where the woodcock nest and feed are those, like us, in their middle years, and these have all the bad features of alders young and old, plus a greasy mud footing and foliage which, even in late fall, is as dense as salad. Once such a mess of alders has been entered, it becomes impossible to tell the time of day, or where you're supposed to be going, or from whence you came, and the only thing you know about your direction is it's not the one the dog's headed in. Every now and then you come upon a dump. The overturned cars and abandoned refrigerators are, at least, landmarks. And if you've been in the alders long enough, they're a positive delight to the eye. The old woodsman's adage about getting lost is, always go uphill. This is a problem in New Brunswick, which doesn't have much in the way of uphills. Indeed, the entire province seems to be on a downhill slope. Anyway, from my own experience, the only thing going uphill when you're lost does is give you a terrific view of no place you've ever seen before. The woodcock are in the alders because the soil is full of earthworms, which is what woodcock eat. The flavor of all birds is notably influenced by diet. A Canada goose shot in a field of corn is a treat. A Canada goose shot on the fourth green and filled with fertilizer and lawn chemicals is disgusting. Fish-eating ducks taste like fish that have been eaten by ducks, and I'm told eating crow is not an empty phrase. Woodcocks are delicious. This raises the worrying thought that we should really be hunting and frying night crawlers. They are certainly easier to find and kill, but worm-digging gear is not going to look stylish in an Orvis catalog. You need a dog to hunt woodcock. Most pointing dogs can be trained to do it, but the breed of choice is the Brittany, a knee-high orange and white canine about as long as he is tall, with no tail worth the mention, and looking like an English Springer Spaniel with a better barber and a marathon-running hobby. Brittanys were bred in the eponymous province of France about 150 years ago, specifically for woodcock hunting. They have a character that is both remote and excitable, yappy and grave at the same time, something like a John Simon theater review. Brittanys are very intelligent, whatever that means in a dog. Does a very intelligent dog have a unified theory of table scraps, or a good and logical explanation for humping your leg? What a Brittany has, in fact, is an intense, irrational, foolish, almost human desire to hunt woodcock. He possesses several techniques. He can run into the outer cover and flush a bird that is much too far away. Flushing is what a hunter calls it when a dog scares a bird silly and makes it fly. It will then fly in any direction that your gun isn't pointed. This, as opposed to pointing, which is when a dog scares a bird even sillier and makes it sit down. The Brittany can also run into the outer cover and point a bird that is much too far away. When a Brittany points, he goes absolutely rigid and still, and does so in a way that makes him look like he's about to hike a dog football or moon a dog sorority house, rather than in that paw-up, tail-out, King Tut tomb painting posture dogs have in sports of field photographs or on placemats from the Ralph Lauren home store. The Brittany is wearing a bell around his neck. The idea is to keep track of the dog in the woods by following the noise of the bell. Then, when the dog goes on point, the bell will stop ringing, and you're supposed to head directly toward. You understand the problem. Brittany's may be intelligent, but the people who thought the bell up were, to put it bluntly, French. The Brittany can also do what it's supposed to do and hunt right in front of you, working close, as it's known, in which case he'll walk over the top of the woodcock, leaving you to flush it yourself by almost stepping on the thing, whereupon it will fly straight up in your face with an effect as nightmarish as a remake of Hitchcock's The Birds, starring Ted Danson and Whoopi Goldberg. When everything goes exactly right, which is none of the time, the Brittany will go on point someplace where I can see him do it. I'll walk up the woodcock, which will take flight at an obliging distance. The woodcock has powerful breast muscles and is capable of almost vertical ascent. It will rise above the alders, beating its wings so fast that its feathers make a loud whistling sound. Then, in a motion called towering, the bird will pause for a moment before flying away. This is when I take my shot. And assuming that the alders haven't jammed my hat down over my eyes or knocked the gun out of my hand, and assuming that I remembered to load the gun in the first place, and that I haven't stepped on the dog while walking up the bird and gotten myself bitten on the ankle, then, if my hand is steady and my aim is true and nothing blocks the way, I'll miss. I regard it as armed shopping, a tame pursuit when you think about it. It's going to the grocery store that's bloodthirsty. Consider all those Purdue oven stuffers you've bought for dinner over the years. How many of them had any chance at all? You mighty Nimrod, you. Everyone you stalked, you killed. Whereas for me, there's hardly a bird that comes before the barrels of my gun that doesn't get away free. Nay, better than free. The bird receives an education about what those orange and white and hairy and pink and winded and pudgy things are doing in the woods. I am a university for birds. Birds, of course, do get shot on these trips, even if not by my gun. And the dog is actually as important to finding dead birds as he is to missing live ones. Woodcock possess almost perfect camouflage, and while difficult to see when living, they, for some reason, disappear completely into the leaf mold once they've been killed. It is hard to imagine what Darwinian benefit there is to an invisible corpse, though there may be one. If the thing that eats you can't find you when you're ready to be eaten, maybe that gourmand will give up on the whole enterprise. It's a modification of the oyster's defense mechanism, which is to look incredibly snot-like at mealtime. Anyway, there are a number of interesting evolutionary questions about woodcock. How'd they lose the beachfront condo? Why would anyone migrate to New Brunswick? And how come they eat worms? Is it a bet or something? According to Guy de la Valdaine's authoritative text on Scalapax Minor, Making Game, Clark City Press, the woodcock has lived in North America since the Middle Pleistocene, for 1.5 million years. But there were no earthworms on this continent until the 17th century. They were introduced in potted plants from Europe and Asia. Before 1600, were the woodcock sending out for Chinese? Also, birds are supposed to be direct descendants of dinosaurs. So why aren't woodcock extinct? My guess is it's because whatever killed the dinosaurs was wearing new bifocals. I don't suppose we'll ever know for sure, any more than we'll ever know for sure whether the Apatosaurus went, beep. At least it makes me feel good to think that every time I dine on poultry, I'm getting even in some small way with Barney and friends. That dogs are able to find birds, alive or dead, is not surprising. Dogs more or less see the world through their olfactory sense. Therefore, what I look like to a dog after a long day in the alders is something I won't dwell on. Woodcock, to judge by our dog's behavior, must smell to a Brittany like coffee in the morning, or arpège at night. The surprising thing is rather that hunting dogs don't leap on the live birds or gobble the dead ones. The whole point of breeding bird dogs is to come up with a poo chew, contrary to every imaginable predator instinct, doesn't catch his prey. He lets you, with your shotgun, do it for him. Or not, as the case may be. It is a fact known only to bad shots that dogs smirk. Suppose you sit a 6-year-old boy on the end of a dock with a fishing pole, and every time the bobber goes under, you grab the rod and land the fish. Suppose you get the child to put up with this all day, and not only that, but like it. V.S. Naipaul, in his History of Trinidad, said, apropos of what I don't remember, and God knows why V.S. Naipaul, of all people, would bring up the subject, that Sir Robert Dudley, circa 1600, illegitimate son of the Earl of Leicester, was noted for being the first of all that taught a dog to sit in order to catch partridges. A remarkable bastard was Bob. And pointing is only half of what dog breeders have accomplished. The dog also retrieves. Imagine, to put this in terms comprehensible to the lowest common denominator of male readers, you found a Victoria's Secret model in your front yard, wearing her professional attire, and intensely interested in affection. And suppose you carefully picked her up, being sure not to hug her too tightly or return any intimate caresses, and delivered her to your next-door neighbor, the guy who's had your skill saw since last February and always lets his crabgrass go to seed. I have no idea what dogs get out of hunting, and once I started to think about that, I realized I didn't have much of an idea what people get out of hunting either. Partly it's a social thing. All of us on the trip are good friends, and it's nice to be off together in a place for which our bosses and offices can never quite figure out the area code. Where was that you said you were going? New Zealand? New Orleans? New Guinea? New Jersey? But we could go to each other's houses and turn off the phones and run through the shrubbery in our old clothes if we wanted. There's nature appreciation. But though New Brunswick has some appealing coastal vistas and some handsome salmon rivers, the province is not a scenic wonder, and the land we hunt is no prettier than the average Ohio cornfield. Still, we do appreciate it. There's something about being out in nature with a purpose, even if that purpose is only to torment dogs and scare feathered creatures, that makes you pay more attention to the outside world. A hike is such a pointless thing, no matter how wonderful the view. You might love the way your house looks, but you wouldn't just walk around and around in it. When you hunt, you have to keep a careful eye on weather, terrain, foliage, and dangerous animals such as me, if I happen to be in the cover with you, swinging my gun around in every direction trying to get the safety to release. There's even a religious aspect to detailed examination of the outdoors. The universe, on close inspection, seems hardly to have been an accident. Or, if it is an accident, it's certainly a complexly ordered one, as if you dropped mushrooms, hand truffles, raw eggs, melted butter, and a hot skillet on the kitchen floor, and wound up with a perfect omelet. That said, alder patches are something God created on a Monday, after a big weekend. Hunting also produces a good, solid sense of false accomplishment. After a long day of bird getaways and gun bungles, of yelling at dogs and yourself, you really think you've done something. You don't get this feeling from any other recreation. Probably it's a throwback to the million years or so that man spent thumbing through the large stone pages of the Paleolithic L.L. Bean catalog. The cave paintings of Lascaux, after all, depict bison hunts, not tennis matches. The fact that my friends and I don't have to hunt to get food may actually be our reason for hunting. Fun can be defined as anything you don't have to do. Or is that right? You have to eat, and eating is the one sensible, if you're not counting calories or the fire extinguisher mess from the little problem I had with flambéing, thing that we do on this trip. Woodcock, like most game meat, is almost fatless and can be cooked as rare as steak without a chicken tartar effect. Woodcock has a slightly liverish flavor, but it is liver to make a Neoplatonist of you. This is the cosmic ideal of liver. Liver in the mind of God, or, anyway, in the mind of Mom. Liver that tastes like your mom thought you should think it tasted. The only real meat on a woodcock is the breast. When cleaning a woodcock, you can split the breast skin with your thumbs and pull the muscle off the carcass. Take this, cut it in half, and roll the halves around in a hot frying pan in good olive oil, with a little salt and pepper, and maybe a dash of Worcestershire sauce, and a sprinkle of rosemary, and you've got something nobody else in the house will touch. It's ugly as a sea slug and smells like tripe, but it tastes superb. We use the drumsticks as hors d'oeuvres, a kind of snob's answer to buffalo wings. Really serious woodcock cooks sauté the trail, the intestines, and serve them on toast. We're not that serious. We have meals of high-savored woodcock. And we have meals of delicate-tasting ruffed grouse, whose meat is to Kentucky fried as the fresh-baked baguettes of Provence are to ballpark hot dog rolls. And we have meals of wild duck, the piquant flesh of which bears not the slightest resemblance to the Donald-flavored item that's bought in stores. Served with all these are steaming heaps of fiddlehead ferns picked from the nearby woods, and bowls of piping New Brunswick potatoes, small as golf balls and sweet as pies, and rolls and buns and scones and jiggling plates of wild foxberry jelly, and pots, tubs, and buckets of strong drink, and desserts aplenty besides. Here at last is something I really am good at. I can tuck in with the best of them, and I get better every year. I have the new holes punched in my belt tongues, and the let-out pants seats to prove it. When dinner is over, we yaw and waddle away from the table, and back to our rooms for one more drink, or five, and to make some truly inventive excuses for our shooting. I was thinking about my ex-wife, and I pulled the trigger too soon. And to tell each other various bits of highly improbable avian lore. Then we are up again at dawn to hunt. Ruffed grouse, or partridge, as it's called in New England, Bonassa umbellus, is an airborne special forces commando chicken. It's about the size of a chicken. It looks like a chicken. It acts like a chicken. Scratches, pecks, and does a chicken walk. But it's decked out in camouflage khakis and browns. And it can fly, which is something a chicken can't do. I know because a fighter pilot friend of mine was once in a furious argument at the officers' club as to whether chickens couldn't fly or just didn't want to. Someone drove to a local chicken farm, bought a chicken, got in an open cockpit biplane, took the biplane to 3,000 feet, and tossed the chicken out. There is a large dent in one of the Quonset huts on that airbase. But the story's better after dinner. Grouse prefer a more gentlemanly sort of country than woodcock. Grouse, like old apple trees on overgrown farmland, brushy edges of conifer forests, and patches of hawthorn shrubs. These last are filled with sinister barbs, but you don't have to go into them. You can send the dog. Nicer hunting ground does not mean nicer hunting, however. I have been consistently outwitted by ruffed grouse. Not that this is any compliment to the bird's intelligence. I have been consistently outwitted by my VCR and my tuxedo bow tie. Nonetheless, for an animal with a, well, a bird brain, the grouse is sagacious. Three of us were hunting a field one afternoon, and the man on the right put up a grouse. Instead of flying away and inviting a shot, the grouse hopped over the man's head and flew straight for the middle hunter at eye level, thereby keeping either from being able to shoot without hitting the other. Repeating the tactic, the bird darted around the middle hunter and flew at me. And when the bird got past me, it broke into every which-way flight maneuvers and reached the woods untouched. A grouse can walk almost as fast as it can fly, and will trot away from most encounters, silent and invisible. The bird rarely holds, and grouse droppings, or chalk, smell more like grouse than grouse do, so you'll often find your dog has spent 10 minutes pointing bird shit. When the grouse does get up, it flies with a tremendous bass note flutter of wings, a tremolo played on the tuba, a noise so startling that you're likely to shoot your hat. As do many game animals, grouse seem to check the calendar. They can be flapping around in scads and passels the day before hunting season opens, and the next morning, they're as rare as intelligent television. The locals in New Brunswick hunt grouse on the ground, waiting until the birds come out on the country roads at dusk to gravel, that is, to swallow the small stones that birds need for their gizzards, to break up food in lieu of chewing. Then the locals blow the heads off the grouse with full-choke 12-gauge shotguns. It's very unsporting to shoot a game bird on the ground, and we disdain this manner of hunting utterly. Unless we need the grouse for dinner, or we've had a bad day, or it's after 3 p.m. The peculiar thing about grouse is their learning curve. Savvy as they are when they're hunted, in locales where they're rarely or never shot, they are sap-green patsies. Some of our usual party went to northern Maine a dozen years ago to hunt grouse at a lodge where most of the customers were after deer, moose, or bear. We found the grouse sitting in rows on tree limbs. Spruce grouse, which are darker and differently marked, are famous for this kind of behavior. Spruce grouse not only look like chickens, but are dumb enough to fly to a Sunday dinner and surrender. But these were ruffed grouse, and no amount of shots and dog barks would budge them. We had to throw sticks to make them fly, and, when even this didn't work and we broke down and shot one off its perch, the next bird in line just shuffled over and took the deceased's place. One of our New Brunswick guides, Tom, who was Indian, says that when he was a kid, his family was too poor to afford shotgun shells, and he used to hunt grouse by sneaking up behind them with a noose on the end of a stick. I wouldn't believe this from anybody but Tom, who is a chief of one of the local bands of Mi'kmaq, and a practitioner of traditional medicine, and spent a year traveling around the United States on a Ford Foundation grant, comparing tribal religious ceremonies. Tom has a shocking ability to see things in the woods and get up close to them. And he can walk through an alder patch without getting poked in the eye by a stick. Tom is a very convincing man. Unfortunately, Tom is also a very convincing man when you're out with him in the far middle of those god-awful, gloomy alder thickets, and the sun has gone down, and you've got no idea how to get back to the car, and he starts telling you about the Jinneh, a giant Indian who turned wild, and if you stumble into his territory, he'll catch you and make you work for him. That is, if you're a woman or a child. "Husbands," said Tom, "the Jinneh eats." Jinnehs are now, I suppose, mostly employed as divorce lawyers. There were also Pugalamuj in the woods, little people who taught the Mi'kmaq how to make canoes and arrowheads. They sound a bit like leprechauns, but more useful, and less likely to make fools of themselves appearing on St. Patrick's Day cards. Tom said you could hear the Pugalamuj whistling. And I believe you can, especially if you're completely turned around in a sea of alders and it's getting real dark. "How do you keep from getting lost out here?" I asked Tom. "Oh, Indians never get lost," he said, looking on every side with an expression as perplexed as my own. "However," said Tom, "sometimes the path wanders away." Another of our guides, Robert, is a retired RCMP officer and an expert on ducks. He can call ducks, shoot ducks, make duck decoys, name from memory every kind of duck found in North America, and give each kind its Latin moniker. Robert can tell you everything you want to know about ducks, except why anyone would ever go hunt them. The idea of duck hunting is to get up at about the time that people who are having fun go to bed and get dressed in dirty flannels, itchy thermal underwear, muddy hip boots, clammy rain ponchos, and various other layers of insulation and waterproofing, then clamber, trudge, waddle, poddle, stumble, flounder, and drag yourself miles into a swamp while carrying coolers, shell boxes, lunch buckets, flashlights, hand warmers, buck knives, camp stoves, toilet paper, a couple of dogs, and 40 or 50 imitation ducks, then sit in a wet hole concealed by brush cuttings and pine boughs until it's dark again and you can go home. Meanwhile, the weather will either be incredibly good, in which case the ducks will be flying in the clear sky thousands of feet above you, or incredibly bad, in which case the ducks will be landing right in front of you, but you won't be able to see them. Not that any actual ducks are required for this activity, and often none are sighted. Sometimes it's worse when they are. The terrible thing about duck hunting is that everyone you're with can see you shoot, and see what you're shooting at. And it is almost impossible to come up with a likely excuse for blasting a decoy in half. Last year, I was in Bosnia, covering the war there for Rolling Stone, and I was hunkered down in a muddy trench behind a pile of shrubbery and tree branches watching tiny Serbs attack in the distance. This seems familiar, I thought. It was, indeed, the very image of duck hunting, although for some reason this time the ducks had the guns. And sure enough, 1 month later to the day, I was hunkered down in a muddy trench behind a pile of shrubbery and tree branches with Robert and my pals. It was pissing down rain. I'd forgotten my pocket flask. Somebody had left the sandwiches in the bottom of the canoe, and they turned into bread and mayonnaise soup. The glass liner had broken inside the coffee thermos. Everyone was out of cigarettes, and the dog had rolled in something awful. Of ducks, there were none, not even any bottom-feeding coot, the recipe for which is planked coot. Arrange bird on a 1-inch thick kiln-dried oak plank. Roast in oven for 2 hours at 350 degrees, basting every 20 minutes with a red wine, olive oil, vinegar, and garlic clove marinade. Throw the coot away and eat the plank. It is only natural that war and hunting are of a kidney. Hunting has been intimately connected with warfare since the beginning of civilization, and before the beginning of civilization there probably wasn't a difference. The traditional leisure activity of archers and lancers and knights and such, when not killing people, was to kill other things. We don't need hunting in the modern world. It makes the wilderness so primitive. It upsets actresses and sensitive undergraduate types. And, anyway, we can easily bag a cheeseburger out the window of our car. But we do need war. At least I assume we do, to judge by the amount of it that's going on in the world at any given moment. And it's my theory that the entire purpose of the annual hunting trip is to make war look, comparatively speaking, like fun. Deep Sea Fishing, Men's Journal, 1992. Imagine a serious, highly competitive, physically demanding outdoor sport that you can play while sitting in a chair drinking beer. Deep-sea fishing is as close as a middle-aged man gets to heaven, unless he's not watching his cholesterol. I was on the boat Lucky Two with Captain Jay Weed and Mate Scott Genereau. We were 16 or 18 miles out of Key West, just past the big coral reef that runs from left to right below the Florida Keys, like the line under an arithmetic problem. The seas were tall and disorderly. The water was such a deep Brooks Brothers suit color that it looked false, blue-tinted contact lenses on a brown-eyed woman. The wind was up, and the sky was filled with tumbling dryer loads of clouds. The Lucky Two is a 34-foot fiberglass cabin cruiser with a 212-horsepower diesel engine. It's purpose-built for sport fishing. But even with this much size and power, the boat was topping and bobbling and slobbering around. Captain Jay was looking for fish. I have no idea how. Maybe he knows their ways from years on the open sea, or maybe they leave their phone numbers on channel buoys. Mate Scott was walking on the heaving deck as though it was so much Kansas sidewalk. He was baiting hooks and tending lines and generally exhibiting the kind of nautical competence that makes such land-loving 44-year-olds as myself feel like shoes for an eel. Everybody on the boat had a job. My job was to not throw up. This is the one entire skill to being a deep-sea fisherman, not punting your bran muffins. Though you have to have a thick spot in your wallet, too, deep-sea fishing isn't cheap. A good boat charter costs between $400 and $550 a day, plus six packs, and a lunch to blow, and a minimum 15% tip to the mate if you expect to go out on that boat again and not wind up trolling schools of pizza anchovies. I must admit I was good at deep-sea fishing. What with a prescription anti-seasickness patch behind my ear and Men's Journal footing the bill, I was, in fact, a regular damned athlete. We were fishing with four rods, seven-foot-long fiberglass poles as thick as rake handles at the butt. Until something bites, these rods sit in holders built into the side rails of the boat. Captain Jay trolled at 4 or 5 knots, a knot being pretty much like a mile per hour, but more expensive. The lines from the rods are baited with fish bigger than what I used to catch and cook in my Midwestern boyhood. Two lines drag directly behind the boat, one on the surface, and another weighted on a deep troll rig to fish 60 or 80 feet under the water. The remaining two lines are held away from the boat by a pair of steel outriggers, which lean over the ocean like high-tension wire towers built by drunks. The Lucky Two has, on its aft deck, a pair of fighting chairs, barber chairs without the barbers. At the front of a fighting chair seat cushion, in line with your crotch, is a socket to hold the base of the fishing rod. Now and then there'd be a sizzle, and line would start hurling off one of the reels. Scott would grab the rod, make sure it was a fish on the hook and not a lobster pot or an overboard beer cooler, then hand it to me. I'd fit the rod into the socket and get busy. There's a lot of excitement when a fish strikes, most of it for the fish, of course. Some game fish leap out of the water when hooked. Some even leap as high as fish do in the photographs on charter boat brochures. And a big fish will run the monofilament out like a teenage daughter on a Visa card credit line. You reel a few times first to set the hook. After that, you work the fish with a pumping motion, pulling back on the rod with all your weight, then reeling like the world's champion egg white stiffener as you bring the rod back down. It's important not to give the fish any slack, though we're talking strictly in physical terms. You can have any kind of emotional relationship you want with the fish. As soon as you've reeled as much line as you can, the fish will run it out again, and you'll pull back on the rod and start over. You do that between a dozen and 100 times while trying not to think to yourself, if it weren't such a big fish and I weren't paying so much to catch it, this would be as much fun as pushing a stalled car to the nearest turnpike exit. We were fishing for sailfish, which, had we caught any, we would have thrown back. There aren't any sailfish anymore, and they are so prized as a catch that most sportsmen let them go. This probably sounds insane if you're not a fisherman, but that's the catch-and-release philosophy. Don't kill these animals, just annoy the hell out of them. We were also fishing for mackerel, especially the big king mackerel or kingfish. These would be sold cheap on the dock because mackerel are, frankly, very mackerel-flavored. Smaller fish, such as cirro mackerel, little sharks, etc., would also be thrown back. There is, all told, a certain futility to deep-sea fishing, but it's a satisfying futility, like having sex with birth control. Hooking a big barracuda was very satisfying indeed. Very futile, too. I mean, I wasn't going to eat the thing. Barracuda tastes like a cat food salad, and they give you ciguatera, an awful disease. And I wasn't going to get it mounted as a trophy. Why would I have something that's as ugly as a divorce hanging on my wall? I just wanted to haul this scaly SOB up to the stern and give him a fish version of an IRS audit. I'd been losing kingfish to barracuda all afternoon. A 30-pound king mackerel would take the bait, jump in the air in a manner spectacular enough to be worth exaggerating later, and put up an admirable, if you admire fish, fight. Then I'd begin reeling it in, and here'd come the barracuda. They'd snap and flash and trouble the water. By the time I got my mackerel into the boat, I'd have only half a fish, and not the cheerful half either. If I got a barracuda itself on the line, its own brothers, its pals, its school of fish mates would do the same thing, gobbling cannibal chunks of flesh. Barracuda are the lawyers of the sea. But the big barracuda I caught must have come off the William Kennedy Smith defense team. There wasn't a bite mark on him. He was about 3.5 feet long, and he weighed 20-some pounds, most of which was jaw muscle, and the rest of which was teeth. Of course, we let him go. Anything as nasty as that must serve some purpose in maintaining the balance of the Earth's ecosystem. Probably it eats ecologists. You see, deep-sea fishing has nothing to do with the enchantments of nature. Our friend and fellow intellectual, the dolphin, for instance. With the help of various activist groups, he has achieved everything except the vote and abortion rights. But out in the blue water, the dolphin is a fish thief and welfare cheat. A hooked game fish is an easy mugging, a finned food stamp to a dolphin. Barracuda take a percentage, vigorous. But a dolphin makes one swipe at a kingfish the size of a golf bag, a kingfish you've been fighting for half an hour, and leaves nothing but the head. Anybody who's seen this will think again before getting into the SeaWorld swim tank with smiling, playful Flipper. Nor does deep-sea fishing have anything to do with nature's brilliant design. I watched for an hour while the same tern flew down and snatched our bait, and then flew away until the monofilament line yanked the fish from its beak. Then the tern would come back and do it again. Like a modern American with a government benefit, the tern couldn't figure out there was a string attached. Deep-sea fishing is about nature. That is mean and stupid. And let us not forget, futile. I suppose this is what Hemingway was getting at in The Old Man and the Sea. Though Ernie could have sent a dolphin as soon as the codger hooked the marlin and saved us all some reading time in high school. Mean, stupid, futile. Nature and middle-aged men have a lot in common. This is one clue to the pleasures of deep-sea fishing. And another clue is that, in order to deep-sea fish, you have to travel to someplace far away from wives, children, jobs, bills, and stationary exercise bicycles. Costa Rica, Cabo San Lucas, Bimini, Cozumel, or the like. I picked Key West because I'd had fun there in the 1970s. At least I think I did. It's all blurry now. But I remember catching record-sized hangovers in bars with 3 bathrooms, men, women, and drugs. It was a dirty little island back then, populated with the flotsam of the seven seas and the jetsam of trailer parks uncounted. But I hadn't seen Key West in almost 10 years. The place has changed. Timeshare resorts have been built where historic liquor stores once stood. Tennis courts blot the swamps, and there's a Santa Fe-style restaurant where a perfectly good parking lot used to be. Key West has become a travel destination filled with, of all things, families. There are families everywhere, ambulating in sunburned clumps, fussing mom, bored kids, dad with eyeball fused to the camcorder. And they're wearing clothes and colors from the spectrum of visible light's dreaded vacation band. These are resort clothes. Clothes with too many zippers, too many drawstrings, too many pleats, buttons, pouches, snaps, pockets, buckles, straps, epaulets, and elasticized hems. Clothes so divorced from normal sartorial function that the Bermuda shorts might as well have 3 leg holes, and every item of apparel was covered with designer logos like smallpox scars. Scattered among the families are double-scrubbed, peach-faced college students, fun-having as hard as they can, getting mirth-filled and perky on 3 light beers. It's amazing how decent, middle-class Americans enjoying themselves in a harmless way create a more repulsive atmosphere than dope smugglers, drunks, sex deviants, and cokeheads ever did. Key West's Main Street, Duval, used to have 5 or 6 terrible bars, 2 flop houses, and a Cuban lunch counter. It is now flanked with unbroken lines of souvenir T-shirt stores. Sample slogan: My buns got toasted in Key West. In the midst of these emporiums is local sing-along king Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville, trademark, a sanitary and wholesome night spot with menu items named after Jimmy's songs. It is so different from the places in Key West where Buffett actually used to drink that the evidence of simile is strained. Suppose the present-day Elizabeth Taylor were given her original part in a remake of National Velvet. It is that different. Margaritaville, trademark, has a souvenir T-shirt store of its own, naturally, where all manner of Buffett memorabilia may be purchased. What a shame this never occurred to the great musicians of the past. Think what Wagner could have done with a Gotthard Dammerung outlet, adjustable Valkyrie hats with foam rubber horns, life-size inflatable Rhine maidens, and personalized gold-plated Nibelungen rings. Better to be out with nature, however mean and stupid. And she was particularly so the next day, with a sky like the bottom of an old frying pan and waves as big as hospital bills. The first thing we caught, though it was large and full of fight, wasn't even a fish. A poor pelican snatched our bait and had to be pulled to the boat and unhooked. It was a wet and difficult business for Scott to get hold of so much angry bird without bird or Scott being too badly hurt. When the pelican was freed, it turned as perverse as a human and hung around the Lucky Two, looking expectant. We caught nothing else that morning, except a couple small yellowtail snappers, which displayed the same color combination as Key West tourists. The boat was being shaken like a bad dog, and the real excitement was trying to take a leak in the Lucky Two's tiny head. I attempted to wedge myself into position, pushing a hand against the ceiling and a foot against the deck, another foot against one bulkhead, and the other hand against the wall behind me, but this left no appendage free to undo my zipper. The only comfortable way to piss would have been to sit down on the toilet and have the john filled with styrofoam packing peanuts to hold me in place. I tried to eat lunch, but the cooler was chucking ice cubes into my lap. My sandwich got blown out of my hand, and my beer leapt out of its gimbal holder and spilled into my topsiders. I didn't have a chance to vomit. My food was doing it for me. There are times, deep-sea fishing, when even the meanest and stupidest middle-aged man wonders if he wouldn't be happier back at the office losing a fortune in leveraged buyouts. Then we got into the blackfin tuna. We found them just on the edge of the reef, where the ocean turns from abysmal blue to a perfect grass green, as though you'd been watering the lawn and just couldn't stop. And now the front yard is 30 feet deep. Blackfins aren't very big fish, never more than 40 pounds. They weigh less than the paperwork from a real estate deal, but they've got as much fight in them as any condo salesman. Blackfins don't do any graceful leaps or acrobatics either. No one ever made a 1950s table lamp with a ceramic base in the shape of a battling tuna. They strike in a quiet, solid way as though you'd hooked the dock. And working the fish, pulling it back to the boat, is a matter of enough sit-ups to make Jane Fonda ditch the exercise business and marry a rich guy. Tuna are dead weight when you're reeling them, and torpedoes when you aren't. One moment of inattention and your line is headed for Cuba, and, when you finally do get the tuna to where it can be gaffed, it shakes its head back and forth like a girl meeting William Kennedy Smith in a bar, and dives, going for the bottom faster than T-bill yields. We caught a bunch of them. Fat, beautiful parabolas of fish, dark-spined with brass highlights along the flanks. The sun came out and the wind went down a little. Flying fish sped down the valleys between the waves. A loggerhead turtle swam by, brown as a Havana cigar, and big as a breakfast nook. The boat quit rocking so badly, or I quit minding so much. I had another 2 or 3 beers. Scott took a fillet knife, grabbed one tuna by the tail, and cut out long, thin, garnet-colored strips of meat. The freshest sushi in the world. Captain J turned the Lucky Two toward Key West, and I settled into a haze of exhausted and slightly alcoholic bliss. One of the quiet joys of middle age is knowing exactly where you are in the food chain: above tuna, below souvenir T-shirt stores. Golf. Men's Journal, 1992. The smooth, long, liquid sweep of a three-wood smacking into the equator of a dimpled Titleist. It makes a potent but slightly foolish noise, like the fart of a small, powerful nature god. The ball sails away in a beautiful hip